Blood of the Summoned. Written, produced, and performed by Philip D. Adams. Chapter 21. Lord Drake. Kit was in no hurry. The others probably expected him to sprint off out the back door and chase Wolfric through the woods. Kit knew better. First, Wolfric already had enough of a head start that Kit would not likely catch up with him on foot, and charging through the woods on horseback would not make it any easier to find him. Kit still had the advantage of knowing who Wolfric was and what he looked like, whereas Wolfric had never seen Kit. He didn't want to waste that advantage on a fruitless chase. At this point, it was really better just to let him think he'd made a clean getaway. Second, it was much easier to track someone in the daylight, especially through the woods, where a person on the run will always leave a breadcrumb trail of hairs, threads, broken branches, trampled underbrush, and even scents for someone of Kit's skills to follow. Perhaps if it had been a clear night with a full moon, he might have been tempted to try. As it was, the night was cloudy and darker than most, so waiting until the sun came up seemed the wiser move. Knowing which direction Wolfric was fleeing would be enough for now. Third, and most important, Kit understood a thing or two about vampires, at least enough to know how vicious they were, and that they were much less dangerous during the day. The last thing he wanted to do was get himself into a tight spot with one of those devils. He was a thief, not a fighter, and though he wasn't afraid of a scrap, he did know his limitations. Tangling with an angry vampire at night was just the sort of thing that could get him killed, or worse. He also knew Wolfric could only run until dawn, by which time he would need to find somewhere to hole up for the day. That would give Kit ample opportunity to close the gap between them, provided he was on the right trail. In the daylight, being on horseback was a decided advantage for Kit, and he intended to make the most of it. As long as he could keep no more than a day's ride behind Wolfric, he was confident he'd find him eventually. Patience and persistence had always been Kit's best weapons, and he'd used them to hunt down many a wanted man for Lord Rodiger over the years. In the meantime, he had some preparations to make. As expected, Kit was able to pick up Wolfric's trail through the woods fairly easily the next morning. When he got to the Dirthington Road, he made a thorough sweep of the woods on either side and concluded that Wolfric had in fact taken to the road, and since north would lead him straight back to Hamsterley, he must have gone south. Kit knew those woods fairly well, and he knew some of the outlaws who populated them just beyond the view of the travellers on the road. Thinking like an outlaw himself, Kit imagined these would be just the sort that Wolfric would seek out. Until he was 19, Kit had spent virtually his entire life outside the law. He was born in a jailhouse to a 16-year-old prostitute named Meg, who had been caught stealing a ham. She was a thin, mousy thing, and when the baby came after she'd been locked up nearly a month, the jailer took pity on her and let her go. From there, she joined a band of brigands living in the woods of Durhamshire. Meg was not much of a thief, as it turned out, but she was comely enough to find men here and there to shack up with, quite literally, but never for more than a few months at a stretch. When she wasn't eking out an existence, servicing the outlaws in the forest, she could be found in town turning tricks for threepence a go. He kept her kids fed, mostly. Kit grew up in the forest among the ruffian class along with several siblings, none of whom he particularly resembled. Unlike his mum, however, Kit was an exceptionally talented thief who began learning the trade at a tender age from the seasoned professionals who populated his woodland community. As he grew up, he developed a superb knack for going unnoticed. He could track a man for miles through brush and bramble and never be discovered. He learned how to pick locks and scale walls with ease. Most of all, he could nick an apple right out of your hand and be gone before you could take a bite. When he put those skills to use, nothing of value was safe around him. By the time he was 16, he had become successful enough at thievery to afford a small place of his own in town. Kit had one other trait that was particularly unheard of among those of his profession. He wasn't too greedy. Adept at sizing up risks and payoffs, he never jeopardized himself by trying for too much at once or by flaunting his ill-gotten wealth. He worked strictly alone and never left anything to chance. Relying instead on his uncanny skills and self-imposed discipline, Kit made his way doing what he knew, determined that the day he was born would be the last he would ever spend behind bars. The one time he slipped up, however, brought an abrupt end to his thieving career. Kit had been watching the home of a wealthy lord, Doric Ormson of Middleborough, and while Lord Doric was entertaining dinner guests, Kit scaled the wall and slipped into the house through a small shuttered second floor window, which he jiggered open as he clung to the corner of the wall. Once inside, he found the master's bedchamber where Dora kept large amounts of coin in a locked wooden box. With the party going on just below him, Kit broke into the box and silently filled his cloth sack with silver pennies and gold shillings. Just as he was finishing, Lady Ormson came into the room to change out of a soiled frock, which a servant had accidentally splattered with goose fat. Kit managed to slink, bag in hand, into the corner next to a large wooden wardrobe, where he pressed himself flat against the wall. For more than 10 minutes, while Lady Ormson changed, Kit stood absolutely motionless and unnoticed. Unfortunately for Kit, in his haste, a single gold coin had gotten caught in the folds on the outside of the cloth sack, and as he stood in the corner, it gradually slid free and fell to the floor with a resounding clang. Lady Ormson's screams brought Doric and one of his guests, a certain Thane of Hamsterley, sprinting up the steps. Ordinarily, such a crime would be punishable by having one's hand lopped off at the wrist. Furious that a thief had been caught in his lady's bedchamber, Lord Ormson wanted both of Kit's hands. As the thief told his story, however, Rodiger became intrigued with how Kit had managed to get as far as he had. In fact, the tale had seemed so unlikely that Rodiger found himself asking Kit questions about every step of the foiled operation. With nothing more to lose, Kit spilled his guts not only about the break-in, but about many of his other exploits, which Rodiger found equally impressive. Then, in one of the most uncharacteristic gambles of his life, Rodiger decided that a man of Kit's talents might be extremely useful to a Thane, if he could be trusted, and he offered to pay Lord Ormson for his prisoner. It was a hefty price that Ormson finally agreed to, with the provision that he be granted the satisfaction of delivering the scoundrel a sound lashing. In the end, Kit was able to keep both his hands, and Rodiger had an uncommonly skilled thief in his employ. Rodiger's hunch, and his generosity, paid off as Kit became one of Rodiger's most trusted and valuable servants, and he had remained so throughout the 11 years since then. Rodiger paid him handsomely, but he needn't have done, since Kit was so grateful for preventing his dismemberment as well as for providing him an honest living that he would have done anything for his new master. Not even Barlow had proved himself more loyal than Kit. Dracovic had expected Rodiger to make a play to take back Hamsterley eventually. He just didn't expect it so soon, and he wished he had been better prepared. It didn't surprise him to see the local louts he'd hired as guards turn tail and run as quickly as they did, but they were the best he could find. Tostig had long since stopped sending any of his Danes to guard the place, and folks for miles around had heard the horror stories about Wulfric the Beast, so only the stupidest and most desperate would dare go anywhere near Hamsterley at any price. Once he had heard the scuffling out front, Dracovic knew the game was up, and he scrambled to hide himself under the floorboards, suffering the blinding torment of the sun's rays long enough to slip out the back door and retreat into a slender crawl space. As soon as the sun had gone down below the horizon, he made a dash for it. Dracovic must have been an odd sight, trekking through the woods on foot in the dark of night in his fine clothing and carrying nothing but a small sack of coins on his belt. He didn't have time to gather any weapons or supplies since evading Rodiger's men was a rather more pressing need at the moment. Finding new shelter before sunrise was the next most pressing need. He knew going back to the village, his usual hunting ground, was out of the question since he was sure they'd be looking for him there. To the south was the village of Morley, where he'd picked up one or two of the goons who were with him at St. Andrews, but he had tapped that well a few times too often, and some of the villagers might be brave enough to tip off his pursuers should they follow him there, which was likely. His best bet would be to find a band of outlaws living in the woods and mingle with them. Perhaps he'd find some shack or cave to stay in until he secured more suitable digs. He came upon a small brook and followed it upstream to the east until it crossed the Durthington Road. That particular stretch ran through nothing but dense woods for miles between there and Etherley. A dandy like him, out at night by himself, would surely attract some robbers eventually. Sure enough, he'd not been on the road a half hour when a tall, heavy-set brute in his mid-twenties, with a tangle of fiery red hair and a beard to match, stepped out of the woods to block his path. He held a thick wooden rod in one hand and was slapping it menacingly into the palm of the other. Dracovic looked over his shoulder to see two more men behind him. One was the thinner, shorter, rat-faced man with greasy black hair and a long, hooked nose that looked like it had been broken more than once. He stood with his arms folded, a long, unsheathed knife hanging from his belt. The other looked like an average-sized man that had been squeezed down to the height of a small child. He had a particularly nasty expression and was carrying a length of iron chain that he swung back and forth.
"What you got in the purse there, mister?" "Enough gold and silver for you and your mates to live like kings for a week."
The red-haired man cocked his head and stepped closer, intrigued by how honest and unafraid his quarry seemed to be.
"Is that so?" "'Tis. And if you're a nice chap and show me where I might find some hovel to crawl into, I might give each of you a penny."
The red-haired man gave a wry smile, followed by a derisive chuckle.
"You're a funny little shit, ain't ya? Bet you won't be grinning when I'm done with ya. Why, what are you planning to do? Take my money?"
The man inched closer so that he was staring Dracovic right in the eye.
"I tell you what I'm planning. First I'm gonna knock that fucking smirk off your face, and I'm gonna beat you bloody. Then I'll take your money, then your clothes, and then I'm gonna fuck you up your arse as hard as I can with this stick. Then we'll see if you're still grinning. Or maybe you fancy that bit, eh?"
The two other men laughed and closed in from behind. Dracovic only smiled.
"I might at that,"
he said, now locking his eyes onto the red-haired man's. A moment later, the red-haired man's threatening countenance suddenly turned to panic. The sneer on his lips dropped, and in its place, a helpless quiver appeared. Soon, he began trembling and his mouth started opening and closing uncontrollably, like a big fat fish. A moment later, he was shaking violently. The other two noticed and stepped back nervously. When the red-haired man suddenly dropped to his knees with a groan, Dracovic turned and looked behind him again, and the dwarf and the rat-faced man both jumped back and brandished their weapons. The sight of their comrade on the ground wailing like a little girl made them hesitate.
"No! No! Please!"
Dracovic saw that the other men were too intimidated to attack him.
"Get your friend and take me to your camp."
"What did you do?"
Dracovic stepped briskly toward the rat-faced man.
"Shall I show you?"
"No. No."
The rat-faced man retreated with his hands up.
"No, it's all right. I'll take you."
He motioned to the dwarf who had stood gaping the whole time, and the two of them got the red-haired man to his feet and escorted him whimpering into the forest. Dracovic followed. About 10 yards in, they came to a footpath, which they followed for about a quarter of a mile.
"How many live back here?" Dracovic asked the dwarf.
"Dunno,"
he said in a voice that belied his diminutive stature, as he carefully avoided making eye contact.
"Maybe 20 or so."
"Is this man the leader of your group?"
"Oh, Rock? No, Rock ain't no leader."
"Do you have one? Is there someone in charge?"
I guess you could say Dean is, right, Reg?"
Yes, I guess you could say that."
"You could, but you'd be wrong."
No one spoke for the next several minutes as they trudged along, the red-haired man whimpering all the way to match the wind that had picked up and was now whining through the trees. Finally, they came to a clearing beside a brook. In the middle was a large blazing fire pit, circled by half a dozen makeshift tents made out of musty old blankets and other scraps of fabric that were now beginning to flap and flutter in the wind. A small animal, perhaps a rabbit, had been skinned and cleaned and was now roasting on a forked oak branch. On the opposite side, nestled against an outcropping of rock, a tiny A-frame shanty had been erected out of plankwood. A smaller fire was burning next to it. Reg, the rat-faced man, pointed to it.
"That's where Dean stays.
Get him. Go!"
Reg scurried off, hopping stone to stone across the creek. Rourke, the red-haired man, stood sniffling, but the dwarf had run off, to where Dracovic did not know nor care. He looked around the encampment and saw half a dozen men, all equally scruffy-looking, standing over the fire warming their hands. They had been leering suspiciously at Dracovic from the moment he entered the clearing in his lordly attire. Dracovic looked past them as if they were just so many rocks and trees. More were huddled inside their tents. After a couple minutes, a thick-set, black-haired man of middling stature strode up. He wore a black woolen cloak and a brown leather cap with flaps that covered his ears. He had a striking face, with a black beard and moustache, and thick black eyebrows. His complexion was ruddy, and his left eye was clouded over in grey, giving him a queer, sinister look. He walked right up to Dracovic, carrying a hand axe, and appeared rather annoyed. He gave Rourke a disgusted sidelong glance, then looked Dracovic up and down and addressed him with a sneer.
"What the fuck do you want? Are you Dean? I might be. Who the fuck are you?" "My name is Dracovic, and I need a place to stay. That wooden house over there will do."
The men standing by the fire began to gather around, and others came out from their tents to see what was going on. Dean looked over his shoulder, then back at Dracovic and laughed.
My house? You mad? Quite, but that's beside the point. Well, you listen to me, Drake, whatever the fuck your name is.
Dean hefted his axe and spoke in a low snarl.
You're going to be dead in about 10 seconds if you don't.
Dean's threat was cut short when the dwarf suddenly charged up unseen and with a feral growl shoved a long knife between Dracovic's ribs, then jumped back to watch his victim fall. Dracovic did not fall. The attack caused him only to let out a yelp and lurch backward a step, but no more. He looked down, enraged at the blade in his side, then fixed his furious gaze on the dwarf. Everyone froze, transfixed on the man who should have been dead on the ground at the dwarf's feet, but instead was lunging like a snake at his assailant. He grabbed the dwarf by his hair with one hand, yanked him up off the ground in a single swift jerk, held him aloft, two tiny hands gripping his wrist for dear life. Without blinking, Dracovic slowly slid the bloody knife out, then, holding the wet blade over the dwarf's face, he let the blood dribble down and onto the little man's cheek and into his gaping mouth. Then, holding the edge of the knife to the dwarf's throat, Dracovic gently pushed his lower jaw up and the dwarf closed his mouth and swallowed. Still, nobody moved. Dracovic looked around, scowling at the gawking wood rats gathered around him. He turned back to face Dean, who stood white-faced and silent. Then, with his eyes still locked onto Dean's, Dracovic thrust the knife into the dwarf's chest and dropped him to the ground, eliciting gasps all around.
I'm sorry. I'll be dead in 10 seconds if I don't... What?
Within minutes, the entire camp watched as Dracovic first ordered Rourke to strip naked, then proceeded to beat him into a bloody heap and rape him savagely with his own stick. After which he did the same to Dean. Dracovic slept in the wooden shanty that day. From then on, everyone in camp did exactly as Lord Drake commanded, without question.